I'm Michelle Magwood from the Sunday Times, and I'm very pleased today to be talking to Siphiwe Gloria Ndlovu. She's the winner of the 2019 Barry Ronger Fiction Prize for her book, The Theory of Flight. Congratulations, Siphiwe. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Some of the judges' comments I just thought I'd read out to you. Utterly captivating, image-rich, a beautifully resolved novel. It's deeply layered. What's also astonishing is that this is a debut novel. But I want to begin today by talking about you. Mm-hmm. You were born in Bulawayo, which is the setting of the novel.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was born in Bulawayo in 1977, in what was then Rhodesia. And I lived there for about less than a year of my life. And then my family, we became sort of like refugees because that was during the Civil War. And then we went to Sweden and we went to America. And then right after independence, we came back. And then I lived there for until after high school. And I went to college in the United States. Was in the United States for 18 years. But Bulawayo is such an amazing place. It's sort of like because of its history, because of its cosmopolitan history, it's a place that stays with you for a very long time. So it's always been home for me.
Mm. And I know you're back there now. So what age were you when you went back to school? You went to high school there?
Yes, I went to a high school called Girls College, and I finished, I think, in 95, my A-levels, and then in 1997 I went to the United States.
So those are really formative years, your teenage years, aren't they?
Yes, and those were the good years for Zimbabwe, the 90s, so I was very lucky to see those, yeah.
You've said in interviews that your grandmother used to tell you stories, mm-hmm. And that she herself was a teacher and told you stories.
Mm-hmm. So my grandmother was a teacher. She taught grade 1 and 2, so she had to sort of like learn how to capture the young imagination. So I was very fortunate because when I was a child, she just told lots of stories, and throughout my childhood she would always tell stories, but she was sort of like a very gifted storyteller, so she would act out, you know, entire scenes from, you know, folklore and stuff, and she just would play all these various characters, and so you're sitting there, you're listening to her, but your imagination is just going through all these places, and she just had this amazing ability to create a story with images and words, and I think I got some of that from her. Oh. I'd like to think that, yeah.
That you thought yourself one day you'd like to be a storyteller.
So the other thing that she gave me besides the oral stories was she allowed me to read books very young and very early. So when I was about 3, 4, I got my first book, and then I just started reading from there, and she would always encourage me to read. There was a mobile library. We used to live a little out of Bulawayo, so there'd be a mobile library that used to come and deliver books, and so we just had this whole reading culture in our family, which was very nice. I think most of Zimbabwe was like that then, not so much now, which is a pity. Most children don't even know where the library is, I think, but it was nice then because everyone was reading and just sharing stories. People would buy books and then share them, you know.
Can you remember what some of those books were?
There was a collection of fairy tales. Then there was the, I think it was Grimm's Fairy Tales, and then there was The Country Mouse and the City Mouse. I remember I really liked that one. Then there was also like a Sesame Street series when I was really young. Yeah, those kinds of books. I also loved The Firebird, that story. Yeah.
Well, that certainly features in this book.
Yes.
We'll get on to that. Was there something else that influenced you to become a writer?
I think when I was about in my teen years, I was very lucky again because I grew up, I think, in Zimbabwe's golden age, which was the 90s. And there was Yvonne Vera, who was a writer, and she was from Bulawayo, and she had a way of talking about the city that just brought it to life. And when you're from there, it just gave you a lot of pride, because if you are Zimbabwean, you know that there are not a lot of stories about Bulawayo, about Matabele, at least not then. And she just had this way of capturing it. And I remember I'd listen to the radio and she'd be reading from the book or whatever. And I'd think, oh my gosh, someone's writing about where I come from, you know. And then I thought, I would like to do that, you know.
And of course, there's also No Violet Bulawayo.
Yes, but that was... She's younger.
Much later. But I'm just saying, yes. You're right. Normally, I mean, so many Zimbabwean books, Patina Gappa, etc., is about Harare.
Yes, yeah.
No Violet Bulawayo, her book was just absolutely brilliant, wonderful.
Yeah.
Opening, that opening sequence where she's running, running through the townships. It's a lovely book. I was going to make the comment, Sipiwe, that there is an astonishing, a burgeoning number of Zimbabwean women writers. Now, yes, you do have your powerful forebears. You have your Tsitsi Dangaremba, you have your Yvonne Vera.
Yeah.
But now there's yourself, there's Novayla Bulawayo, there's Patina, there's Panache. Would you hazard a guess as to why? Is there something that underpins this phenomenon?
You know, I think it's the, again, like being born at a particular moment. I was at a conference with Panache, and she was talking about how she doesn't remember the golden age of Zimbabwe because she's too young to remember that. But I think if you look at people like Sunyati, people like myself, who sort of like were there in the 90s, I think it's that break, the 2000-2008 break, that sort of like makes you start asking very difficult questions, you know, makes you want to find these answers very quickly. I think the generation you were talking about, the Tsitsis, they had the sort of like liberation struggle and what happened right afterwards to sort of like contend with. And then we had our own moment, which was sort of like this, okay, now we're all over the place. There's this diaspora. What does this mean? How are we a nation now, you know? Whereas they were asking like after the war, what does this mean for sort of like personal politics between husbands and wives, fathers and children, whatever? You know, now we're asking like what does it mean that we'll all live somewhere else and like are leaving home and there's this brain drain? So I think there are these moments, and I think you're seeing that response to that moment from these writers. Novuyo is another one. You know, like it's just an amazing time to be a Zimbabwean writer because there's so many people out there writing about what has happened in the past 10, 15 years.
It is an amazing time. And you are asking some very urgent questions yourself in this book. Sipiwe, I'm going to ask you to read the prologue to the book, because not only does it encapsulate the story wonderfully, it also gives us a sample, if you will, of your writing.
Okay. So this is the prologue. On the 3rd of September, not so long ago, something truly wondrous happened on the Beaufort Farm and Estate. At the moment of her death, Imogene Zulanyoni, Jeannie, was sent to fly away on a giant pair of silver wings, and at the very same moment her heart calcified into the most precious and beautiful something the onlookers had ever seen. A few had already chosen to witness this event. However, most of you have eyes that are not for beauty to see, and because of this, you will not believe that such a truly amazing phenomenon did take place. It is because some of you will have doubt, and those of you who do not have doubt will be curious, that the story is choosing to be told. Like any event, what happened to Jeannie did not happen in a vacuum. It is the result of a culmination of genealogies, histories, teleologies, epistemologies, and epidemiologies, of ways of living, remembering, seeing, knowing, and dying. In other words, the story of what happened to Jeannie on the Beaufort Farm and Estate on the 3rd of September is also the story of how Bane Stigiti, in a bid to quench his wanderlust, walked into the Indian Ocean, of how Prudence Ngoma learned how to build character, of how Goli de Gumede shot down an aeroplane and in so doing created a race of angels, of how Elizabeth Nyoni sealed her fate with the turn of her ankle, of how Dingane Masuku came to be haunted by the blue violet flowers of his mother's dress, of how Thandi Hadebe looked into the distance as though it held a future in which he was not particularly interested, of how Crystal Masuku at puberty welcomed guilt as a constant companion, of how for Marcus Masuku love happened under a jacaranda tree while he was listening to a story about a swimming elephant, of how Valentine Tanaka became a hunchback with a heart of gold, of how Jesus came to be saved, and of how the Beaufort Farm and Estate knew exactly what to do with its sacrifice, darlings.
One of the strengths of Sipiwe of the book is your characterization and the characters that you create. There's a wryness often to them. For example, one of my favorites is Bane Stigiti. How did he get his name?
You know, when I was a child, there were a lot of surnames that had been taken from an English word, and you could tell, like, I went to school with someone whose last name was Pickup, because, you know, obviously there had been something about the name that the forefathers had liked, and so they had sort of, like, incorporated it. And I thought it would be so nice to have a character who has Africanized English last name, you know. So Tikiti was very interesting that way, but also because it means ticket, you know, and it's sort of like this man who has this strong drive to just see places and see the world, but is very limited in what he can do. So it was sort of like a way of talking about that desire that he has. Like if he just had this ticket that would allow him to see everything, his life would be so much better. But yeah.
But you also mash it up with Baines. Mm. And of course, Thomas Baines was a colonial explorer.
Yes. So I wanted to have, so in him is sort of like this feeling like he should be a part of that exploration history, right? So like these great men who went and charted new territory. But because, and interestingly enough for him, he doesn't see it as a limitation because of the color of his skin. He sees it as it's the moment that I was born in, right? I was born too late to be an explorer, and he really, really wants to be that. So he changes his name, right, from Bafana Ndlelapi to Baines Tikiti because he's giving himself this freedom to travel.
The book's been described, and I think rather lazily, as magical realism, and I think magical realism has become a lazy phrase that people use too much. But for instance, Jeannie, she's hatched, your main character Jeannie, she's hatched from a golden egg and she flies. How did the story come to you, and I mean also then the telling of the story?
I think the sort of like the basic story came because I had lost someone, and that's who the book is dedicated to. So someone that I grew up with, she was 4 years older than me, and then when she was 34, she passed away. And then I had to ask myself, what does that mean? You know, she was my aunt, she was my mother's younger sister, she was my grandmother's daughter. And so we're all grieving this person, but what does that mean? Are we grieving the same person? So it was that question. And then I think, you know, luckily, I just sort of like had these different characters start visiting me in order for me to tell this story. And they just were very compelling, very colorful. Not always easy sometimes to see, but they were all there and they were started having this life. And it was just very interesting to sort of like then start thinking about the questions that I wanted to ask through these people. And I, you know, Jeannie was sort of like a huge draw, but she was extremely elusive. And for a while that was frustrating because it was my debut novel. And I thought, okay, I need to know her. You know, when you go to creative writing classes, you know, what does your character eat? What does he, when she goes to the shop, what does she buy? And she wasn't giving me a lot of stuff. And I thought, oh, you know, what's going on here? But I think that was the whole point of what I was trying to get at, is that you get a little bit of someone, you see them from an angle, you don't see the whole. And so that's what she gave me, was people who were seeing her from these different angles. Oh. But it took me a while to arrive at understanding that that's what was happening in the story.
The voices are so distinctive of the characters. And I think, you know, I think you are a filmmaker, and it's an intensely visual book as well. I mean, I think of the descriptions of those sunflowers, the fields of sunflowers, the hazy blue hills, etc. I sense that a lot of it was happening in your mind, those scenes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but also from my own life. I think the sunflowers definitely, I got that because when I was a child, I used to spend a lot of time in sunflowers, and when I used to look out the hazy blue hills. But I think a lot of it definitely had to be, like the imagination just started there, but just took off from there, you know, and the story definitely is not about my life, but definitely moves on, and yeah.
Mm. Are there any novelists that you think influenced you? Mm. I think Marquez is in there, but one of the judges thought maybe Zeke Simda.
Zeke's actually taught me when I was in Ohio. He taught me literature. And I think I remember reading The Madonna of Excelsior, which is an amazing book. And with The Ways of Dying, which I love. So yes, I think so. I do think that Yvonne Vera and Siti Dangarembga are huge influences. But so, you know, Toni Morrison and Alice Walker and, you know, that whole group of women. I think I like people who value language when they're writing and understand the power of words and the written word. People who play around with it in very interesting ways. I think I've always been drawn to those kinds of writers.
And you show that in your writing here. The book examines a shattering history, Sipiwe, colonization, civil war, Kukuruhandi, the cleansing of the in Matabele land, the massacre in Matabele land. And yet, Jeannie seems to represent hope.
Mm-hmm.
I think what I'm asking is, how do you balance that shattering violence with the hope of the Jeannie character?
I think that just came from experience. I think, you know, you hear a lot about Zimbabwe in the media, like, oh, you know, the economy is devastated, this is going on, the politics is awful. But then when you go there, and people are laughing on the street, people are cracking jokes, people are standing in a line for hours, but they're finding things to laugh at, or creating the most incredible memes and things, and you think, what's going on, you know? So I think Zimbabweans, and I think most people in the world, just have this ability to, yes, go through difficult things, but also just hold on to themselves and hold on to what makes them happy. I think I just don't want to have anything to do with sort of like that everything is painted with a black brush kind of look at history or the present. You know, it's just like there's complexity everywhere. You know, there's nuance in everything. So even in the most dire situation, you know, there's hope, there's happiness, there's love. People fall in love in the most weird circumstances, the most difficult circumstances. So I wanted to capture that because that's my experience of life. That's my experience of coming from Zimbabwe, being part of Southern African history, that, you know, we have as a region had a very violent history, but we're not particularly always these browbeaten, sort of like downtrodden people. You know, we have a lot of laughter, a lot of love, a lot of, you know, we just, yeah, we embrace life.
Absolutely.
So,
as you say, there's life and love there all the time underneath if you look for it. What do we, this is a difficult question, that is, what do we do with the weight of history? What do we do with the weight of sorrows? How do we carry it? And I'm asking you now, in a time when Robert Mugabe has died, the country is still struggling with a new leader. What do we do with the weight of our history?
I think you have to face it, and I think you have to address it. I think a lot of the times, I always say to people, you know, in Zimbabwe, for instance, in the Civil War, there was a lot of violence against sort of like just ordinary people. Yes, it was these groups of factions fighting each other, but the people who really got hurt and damaged were the people in the village, for instance, you know. Same thing in the 80s. It's not the people who are fighting each other who get it, but it's the people who are just sort of like sitting in the middle of nowhere who get it. Same thing in 2000, same thing in 2008. And so if you're not going to face that, if you're not going to say, we've had these cycles of violence and this is what they've created, this is the kind of prison that they've created, or this is what they've done to the body. Because just because we're walking around laughing, like I just said, and loving and smiling, doesn't mean that, you know, we're metabolizing the pain. Sometimes it's just there. It's not doing anything. It's just there. And that's dangerous, right? Because then you can just pass it on and pass it on and pass it on. So I think it's important to actually sit there and sort of truthfully address what happened, put blame where it needs to be put, and just sort of like move on. You know, in Zimbabwe, whenever there's an election, people will bring up Kukuruhandi, for instance. But it's sort of like a political tool. You know, no one's actually going to address what happened. And that needs to happen if people are going to move on. You know, you can't just say, oh, that happened, and then move on. That happened, and what are you going to do about it? Then we can move on. And so I think there has to be those moments where you just have to reckon with the past and just say this. And it's not to just lay blame on people and say, you did something bad to me, but it's like, how do we heal as a people and move on from this together, you know?
I like that word, metabolize. I think that's a very important word. There's an old friend of mine who works in Zimbabwe. Her name is Shari Apple. I don't know whether you know her.
Oh, yes, John Apple, ex-wife.
Yes, and she has worked, she's a human rights activist, and she has worked with torture victims, etc. And she went and studied forensics so that she could do what she does now. And she's part of an organization that is returning the bones of victims who have been found in mass graves, returning them to their villages, to their families, to their communities. And one of the ways they have, in fact, your book reminded me, is of determining when and where when these people were killed, was that they have coins in their pocket. So it'll be a 1975 coin, etc. And I just think that that kind of work is astounding in terms of reparation is the word I'm looking for. And yeah, to go back to what you just said, you know, metabolizing the pain and to bring that kind of closure to families.
Which is very important.
Which is very, very important. So you have gone back to Bulawayo. You've been away a long time. You were here in Johannesburg for a long time. What work were you doing here?
I was a teacher at a place called the African Leadership Academy. And I was teaching African studies and writing. And I enjoyed it, but I think I wasn't prepared necessarily for the amount of work that goes into being a high school teacher or like a teacher. So I thought I'd be able to write and teach at the same time, but that wasn't working. So I decided, okay, I'm going to have to put this aside for a little bit and just focus on the writing, which is what I'm doing now. And it was, I thought it was time to go home because I actually haven't been home or lived at home as an adult ever. So I thought it would be a nice time to do that.
And I know you've you're busy on the second, or might even have finished the second novel. I mean, no pressure now. If you were having one, having one the very wrong with your first book, but I really look forward to reading that.
Oh, thank you. I can tell you a little bit. It's called The History of Man. It will be out in July 2020.
Good. And everyone has commented since the day this book was published on the beautiful cover. Gretchen van der Bale, who designed it. And so, again, that's quite something to live up to for Gretchen to design another one.
Yeah.
But congratulations again.
Thank you.
And we look forward to that new novel.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Final Take, a multimedia live production from the Tissot Blackstock Group, publishers of the Sunday Times, Business Day, and Financial Mail.